over Baghdad has been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going on all over the sky.
Welcome to another episode of Radio Contra, the home of the Mossy Oak Militia, the boys that are always DTB that's down to Boogaloo, and the podcast of American Partisan. I'm your host, NC Scout, and in this episode, which is brought to you by Ammo.com, you don't have enough ammo for what is coming down the pipe, Ammo.com. Your supplier for all things that go boom and got really great prices as well. Click the link in the sidebar as well as down below and you will get $15 off that first order of $200 or more. But in this episode, I had the honor of doing a podcast interview with the legendary author, Navy SEAL, host of the fourth hour of Alex Jones Show, Matt Bracken. And we discuss a wide range of topics, most of it centered on COVID-19 and some of the concerns that we have coming out of this, as well as societal concerns and whatnot. But I had a great time. And again, like I said, it was a huge honor to have interviewed him, and I think I got a lot out of the interview, and hopefully you will as well. This podcast and this interview is also brought to you by Palmetto State Armory, Primary Arms, and Gun Mag Warehouse. And as always, if you don't have the ability to fight at night and own the night, but yet you have five or more AR-15s or what have you, you might want to consider selling some of those off and picking up some good night vision. Ready-Made Resources, my friend Bob Griswold over at Ready-Made Resources has some of the best deals on the net, bar none, on Gen 3 sets. And if you're not thinking about getting Gen 3, and if you're going to do it right. Get the best. If you're not thinking about getting Gen 3, maybe you ought to. Maybe you ought to. Anyhow, let's get on into the interview. All right. And we are live here with veteran Navy SEAL, well-known best-selling author, and my friend, fellow American Partisan writer, a guy that I've respected for an incredibly long time, going all the way back to his original novel, Enemies Foreign and Domestic, Mr. Matt Bracken. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning. Maybe one of the last ones, the way this virus is spreading.
So, on that topic, what are your thoughts as we move forward on the coronavirus?
I think this could cause Trump to lose the election. I think that politically, there's like a knee-jerk reaction where if the Democrats are hyping it and blaming it on Trump, instead of parrying it and saying, yeah, it is bad and I'm not denying it, the Republicans, like the Rush Limbaugh faction, things like that, had a counter reaction that no, it's just like the flu. And they're still stuck in this ditch of, well, you know, 20,000 a year die from the flu and only six have died from coronavirus. And this to me is this really indicates to me that a lot of Americans are still like in a, They can't understand geometric progression. They really don't. And maybe it's the normalcy bias thing. And my analogy is that when they hear these numbers, they say, they're comparing it to a daily tide that goes up and down 3 feet. And they're not comparing it to a tidal wave because they haven't seen it. They don't believe it. Even though this tidal wave has hit China, Italy, Iran, it's in like 60 countries around the world. This tidal wave, it hasn't come to their town, so they still don't believe it, and they're still stuck in the denial phase of more people die from the flu. But the numbers that people are not grasping that are so important, you know, this disease we know from China, and you know, some of the numbers are at variance because the amount of testing is very widely differing. You know, you can't really trust the Chinese numbers. You can trust the Korean numbers, but you know, as more testing is available, the test sample expands greatly. So it's hard to graph cases versus deaths because the testing is so at variance. I mean, in America, we've still tested only like 600 people. And then people confuse it with screening. We're screening people at the airport. All that means is, if you've been to Iran, are you carrying a fever? That's nothing. That's meaningless. So they're still obfuscating testing with screening. And we're so far behind the curve. And this is where Trump could lose the election. When China started blowing up in January, it should have been like a Los Alamos Manhattan project to gear up our own test kits. You know, reliable, verifiable test kits and PPEs, personal protective equipment, because everybody out here that's intelligent knew that the supply chain was broken. I went to the big box, Home Depot to buy my own PPEs. They were all made in China. And even 2 weeks ago, the masks, the N95 masks, had like a limit of per customer, which I never saw before. So the supply chain is broken. We're going to massively need more PPEs and test kits, and there's no more coming. So as the numbers go exponential, we're basically screwed. And the president is still in a, don't worry, there'll be a miracle. Literally, he said that, you know, it'll be like a miracle. It's just going to go away. This is like ghost dancing. You know, the bullets are going to turn into water and go through us. You know, because we're Americans and we're the best, you know, we're the most prepared. Well, all of these statements are going to come back to haunt Trump in his reelection campaign. And I don't think that we can even guarantee that there will be conventions in person, because the pandemic might eliminate large gatherings like that, especially if people come from 50 states. They're all getting to sit together, right. And then that's going to be out the window within a month. So it's going to be very tricky holding an election, period. So we're probably going to have like a virtual election online with a virtual convention online because of the safety considerations. And yes. I think that by then it's going to be clear that Biden is senile as hell. He can't possibly be president. And the Democrat establishment still won't want Bernie, because he'll blow up the entire power structure. I think that we're going to have a brokered convention that'll be online, you know, which nobody will trust, because it'll seem like it's an ephemera. It's just like an illusion, you know, a Hollywood production, like a moon landing that's faked. Nobody's going to trust a virtual convention or a virtual election. And, you know, so no matter who wins, the other side is going to deny that it's legit. And so it's going to be really tough for anybody to lead coming out of this. And the social control mechanisms that will have to be, you know, taken, like they are in China and Korea, I don't think they can be done in America. You know, the East Asians have a pretty high IQ. And obviously, China is extremely authoritarian dictatorship. In China, they can order people to stay in your house or else. You know, if you come out of the house, you're going to a quarantine camp, never to be seen again. So they can make quarantine stick. And apparently that's what it requires to get the infectiousness down, is mass quarantine in cities across China with no industry. You've seen those pollution maps of China. There's like no smokestacks burning. China is shut. And they can do this in Korea to a more limited extent without as much coercion. But the Koreans, being very high IQ, the South Koreans, they get it. Yeah. And they'll line up. I've seen pictures of them lined up for miles for food and face masks. That will not cut it in Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles. There will be looting. Yeah. When the panic sets in, there will be looting. There will be people fighting over the last masks and the last food. You know, our society can't handle a stress test like this. You know, we're like a jalopy going around a mountain turn with the wheels almost coming off on a good day. You know, and now you're gonna blow up the bridge in front of us. And we're just expecting, because we're Americans, our jalopy is going to fly over the gap. You know, I don't think we can do this stress test. That's my fear.
I don't think so. Yeah, to your points, because we have, and this is a good thing about America, but it's a double-edged sword, because we have this ideology that's based in individualism, that we, down man to man, we have this attitude of, I got mine, screw you. And when we apply that in mass and we look at the aftermath of human disasters, natural disasters, Katrina is one that sticks in a lot of people's minds because it was so visceral. If we apply that, and this is worst case scenario, if we apply that to a pandemic, one thing that I'm concerned about too with that is with the potential for a breakdown and kind of that attitude, who is going to police things? If our military is riddled with this disease as well,
they're on quarantine too. They're quarantined too.
Yeah. So who's going to be out there? And if you look at the moves the Chinese have made in Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean and stuff that has gone completely unnoticed in our media, they have a logistic train, because everything is based around logistics. They have the logistics as they've put in place. Because I've long said, and this is something that I picked up from your novels with the North American Union troops that came from Central and South America, they have to get manpower from somewhere. You know, and if they don't trust the military or the United States military is rendered inefficient or incapable in one way or another, or is socially neutered, as we're seeing right now, policies have been put in place in the last 8 years, conversations you and I've had about issues with women in special operations, so on and so forth. Our combat capabilities are neutered, and all of a sudden our troops are placed on quarantine because of, you know, a virus. Who is going to provide the manpower for the security? And if we welcome in with open arms a savior,
you know? If things become desperate enough, and it's likely they might, then people are going to start putting up neighborhood roadblocks, and they won't care if somebody on the other side says, I'm the deputy, I'm the National Guard, I'm the U.S. Army. They're going to think, we're not infected in our neighborhood, but you're infected out there. You're not coming in. I don't care if you're from the UN or the U.S. Army or the North American Union. You're not coming in, because strangers means infection. So it'll change the dynamic totally. And what you said before about logistics, you know, there's a great saying that amateurs talk about strategy and tactics, and professionals talk about logistics. And if China, with its overbearing social controls, you know, you have to hold up your smartphone with a QR code on demand, like 100 times a day in China, plus the facial recognition, but with everybody in a mask, which also is mandated, you have to hold up your phone with a QR code. So they know where you are, where you've been. They've got so if they come out of it first, and they are currently the factory to the world, they're going to be the only ones capable of gearing up to provide whatever medicines are and treatments are invented, you know, they're good at copying. You know, the vaccine may be a year or more off, and there may not even be a vaccine, because a lot of people compare this to the SARS, which is another coronavirus. And the SARS vaccine, the way that it's built, the way a SARS virus is built, the vaccines that they tried on dogs and some humans were worse than the, you know, it was take your chances with the disease, because the vaccine caused like permanent lung damage, you know, to the dogs and the few humans it was tried on. So they actually withdrew the vaccine, and fortunately the SARS epidemic subsided naturally. But you know, everybody's putting their hopes on some miracle vaccine, which may or may not come. This may be something which severely depletes the population. I mean, look at this in Africa. There's not going to be any attempt. I mean, if Iran at least is going through the motions now with people on subways, you know, at least you see videos. It's probably a lot of propaganda, but you see videos coming out of Iran. They've at least got some attempt at personal protective equipment with the ambulance drivers and so on. In Africa, that's going to be non-existent. And people right. don't grasp yet. When people hear, 85% of the people recover, that's meaningless. That's meaningless. If you were in a company of soldiers and 15% just got shot, you got a big problem, number one. But 85%, it doesn't matter. It's like saying most people get shot with a 38 are going to survive. But that's not the point. If the survival rate is 2%, just rough numbers, the survival rate of infected people with coronavirus is 2% if they have access to first world medical health, meaning an isolation ICU. Once the hospitals are overrun because of the geometric spread of cases with this high R-naught value, once the hospitals are overrun, forget the ICU. Now the 15% severe rate becomes a 15% mortality rate. And in our society, a 15% mortality rate would mean bodies in the street that aren't being picked up. Then you got all kind of
right.
problems after that. I mean, social, economic, not to mention, once people start seeing bodies in the street, the stores will all be looted. So you start talking second and third order effects. And in China, they can order people to go out and pick up bodies. They can order people to stay in their house or go back to work at the factory. You know, they can in China, they can make a critical decision, you know, weighing the pros and cons of the death rate, that we need to open this factory making medicine or PPEs. We need to open it, even if it means we're going to feed people into it like the Gulag salt mine. We're going to feed people into it, but we've got to keep that critical assembly line working. They can do it in China because they can force people to do it. And there's some question right. about the overall Chinese economy, but at least, you know, they can organize and structure their society to force this. In our country, people would not go to work, period. The economy comes to a standstill.
Well, in China, and we're already seeing this, that there's been some news stories that have come out that they're using the Muslim minority in far western China, that the Chinese are trying to keep them under a very tight rein. They're using them as slave labor in their.
Well, they've always done that in the Korean War. They used when we hear Americans talking about human wave attacks by people that didn't have guns, you know, you're put out of the troop truck and you're just told get a gun when you get close to the Americans from a guy on the ground. Those were the nationalist Kuomintang troops. So they used did the same thing. The Russians did the same thing. They had the penal battalions. You know, you cracked a joke about Stalin, you were in a penal battalion. You're going to be clearing landmines.
Yep.
So the communists are very willing to go to that strategy of just using humans. And we're not, our hands aren't completely clean either. I mean, we did the nuclear testing after the war, where we marched soldiers into the nuclear crater, you know, a half hour after the blast, just to see what would happen.
Yeah. McNamara was famous for that. They took low IQ troops and put them out there, and you know, those tests are being released now, the findings from that, because you know, there was no FOIA back then. Everything was
you know, hush hush Cold War stuff. But you know, when we're talking about Marxists and communists, you have to understand that with a Marxist, morality is relative. Everything must satisfy the end goal, whatever right. supports the revolution for them. And so, bingo. And the same is true with their doctrine on warfare. But so with that said, from here moving forward, what do you suggest that people should be doing in preparation for all this?
Well, in some ways, all of the plans that we make are for something less insidious than a virus carried by asymptomatic spreaders. People say, oh, children and young people don't get it. That may be true, but they may also be spreading it. So they suffer the symptoms, but they might give it to all the staff at the school. So it's very insidious. In my third trilogy novel, Foreign Enemies and Traitors, just for a plot device, I start it with a massive earthquake in the middle of the country that allows me to write several scenarios regionally, you know, with foreign troops being brought in, people being ordered to leave their areas and go to relocation centers and then refusing. I think none of that is off the table, but in a sense, it's worse because the fear of asymptomatic spreaders means that the social trust will be blown up. Not only people won't go to work, they won't let people, you know, on their property. They won't let people in their subdivision. But then the food starts to run out. Right. Now, something common to all of these crises that seem to come out of nowhere, and I'll just like reference a couple from modern history that are fairly modern societies. You know, first world level of, or if not first world, a lot of the first world technology. You would look at, say, the Bosnia, you know, Serbia, broken former Yugoslavia wars, where all of a sudden the supply chains are literally cut off because, you know, you've got mortars and sniper alleys and artillery raining on cities. You run out of food real fast. And same thing with like Syrian civil war. You know, when your city starts getting shelled, your actual apartment might be intact, but there's no running water and there's no food coming in. In a pandemic situation in our country, you won't be worried about artillery shells necessarily, hopefully, but you will be worried about when is the last day that your water tap is going to work, because there are human beings at the water facility that have to go to work also, and they have to have a supply of the sterilizing agents, whatever sterilizing agents that they're using, to ensure that the water coming out of the tap won't poison you. So if the economy contracts to the point where people are afraid to even go to work, well, that will include the people at the electric company and the water company. So in all of these, looking back at all of these, everybody uniformly says, I wish I'd gone to the supermarket and maxed out my credit card, you know, no matter, just stack rooms full of food, because no matter how much you have, it's not enough. People say, well, for a hurricane, I just need a week. That's nothing. A Bosnian civil war, how many years do you need? You know, you have to go out looking for food, if your family is out of food and you're tried eating bark and grass like North Korea, when dad, who's also the prime bodyguard of the family, when dad has to sneak out to the looted supermarket trying to find something, you know, lost under the dumpster, the supermarkets are going to be like the diminishing water hole. I've seen these documentaries where they have drought cycles in southern Africa, like in Namibia and Botswana, where there's a flourishing ecosystem that'll last for 10 or 20 years. You know, there's a continuous river full of hippos and alligator or crocodiles, and it's a flourishing ecosystem. But as you get a drought cycle, it goes down to just bow lakes, and then mud holes with all the hippos and crocs in the same mud hole. And eventually it dries up. And eventually your food runs out. Dad has to go out looking for food. Well, dad may not come back because that last water hole is going to be surrounded by lions and full of crocodiles. You know, the people that have no food but have a gun are going to be waiting for the guy who might have you know, a gold piece to try to find to buy a bag of rice somewhere. But it can get to the point where you're looking for individual grains of corn that fell out of a relief package off the truck. I mean, that's where you're right. Literally starving. And people that think that we're America, therefore there's this like angel shield over us. You know, the laws of physics and economics don't apply to us. They're wrong.
Yeah, we're not immune to that. And, you know, although it's not a direct analog, most recently, if people go back and look at everything that came out of Venezuela, you know, just a year ago, over the past couple of years, and they're coming out of that a little bit now, only because of the austerity measures that both Russia and China are offering them. I mean, they're propping up Venezuela's economy. But if you look at the first 18 months of their real decline, when the dominoes really started to fall, and you saw those reports of people going to the zoo, killing zoo animals. Right. And, you know, we think in America, our cultural relativity to that is instant aversion. Oh, my God, those people, how would they do that? But you don't understand that what real starvation is, what real hunger is, you know, and when we talk about America, the poor in America still have television. They still got their smartphone. They still got, you know, food on their table, you know, three hots and a cot. They still have all that. And you know, when you go to the third world and you get to looking at real poverty, I'll never forget that the culture shock that I got the first time I went to Iraq and I saw people in a gas station in Iraq, in this part of Iraq, in Kirkuk, was guys selling gas, or what they call benzene, out of 5-gallon jugs on the side of the road. And that was it. That's all they've got. You know, and that level of poverty is something that in the United States we can't fathom, because when you hear Bernie Sanders or you know, a real socialist on the left, not the corporate socialists that we get with our, you know, the Elizabeth Warrens and the Bidens, but the real hardcore leftists, you know, Sanders and AOC. Go ahead.
In a social way, this makes us less prepared and more vulnerable, in the same way that, say, third world people have right. a much tougher gut. They have an immune system because they've been drinking ditch water, and Americans have been drinking chlorinated, fluoridated water. But the social level, our expectation is that everybody has a happy ending. You know, that in I was thinking about writing for something for American Partisan just about the social outlook on death has changed so much since the 19th century and then the oncoming of penicillin. People didn't used to expect to live to an old age. And funerals, people used to have their relative out in the living room on a table for like a day for everybody to come and see them and say goodbye. That laying out at home was common, and children saw it. They knew that you could get sick and die, or you could hit your leg with an axe, get an infection and die really fast. So the expectation was, you know, that's part of the reason why people over, say, 70 were so respected, because they had beat all the odds. That was so rare. But now the expectation is, not only is food, I can go to a fast food, and if that's not fast enough across the street, it's faster, you know, and you're pissed if it takes you 5 minutes in line at McDonald's. So our expectation of instant gratification and happy outcomes, you know, at the end of every TV show, the hero wins and the patient survives. But that's leaving us more psychologically vulnerable, just like our gastrointestinal systems are more epidemiologically vulnerable, because we're like the boy in the bubble for the viruses. We're also socially like the boy in the bubble, because the Kardashian type of mentality, you know, everybody's happy all the time, is not going to deal well when things go sideways and there's bodies laying in the street. And, you know, Dad comes back from the supermarket and says, I was too late. It was already looted. We got no food.
Yeah. Well, and to that point about the social ramifications, culturally, the United States needs to change. We have been ingrained with the just-in-time supply system that has kind of fostered this mentality. People are going to realize at some point that you might only get one meal a day. You might only get that. You might only get, and that one meal a day might only be, a quarter of a cup of rice and maybe a little bit of corn. And that's all you've got, because in more primitive civilizations and more, I'll say in the third world, they have great feasts because that is about the time of a harvest, of a significant harvest. But in the day-to-day mealtime, you don't have these big extravagant meals. Yeah, you may not have meat or
even in post-war meal. Britain had severe rationing because post-war Britain did a social snap to socialism after the war. We've won the war, Churchill's out. Well, right through into the 50s, Britain was dirt poor with rationing. My Welsh brother-in-law, who was a little boy at the end of World War II, he said they had a capon chicken once a year on Christmas. That was the only meat he saw growing up. Once a year on Christmas, the family shared one chicken. And that was Britain. We're not talking about Somalia, but the human being evolution-wise was made to be a hunter-gatherer that had to run after food or guard it and protect it. And there were seasons when food was short. You could load up on berries in one season, but then all winter you had to have laid in some kind of hard rations. So people were a lot hungrier normally, and that was what we were designed to be. We were not designed to have all the sugar and salt we want and all the, just at will. But that's a medical issue. Maybe it'll be good for us to lose weight in a sense. But socially and psychologically, we're not ready in America to drive down the street and have people throwing rocks at us on the way to a looted supermarket. Because the people that have no food on the second week are going to look at a prepper who's not losing weight. Let's say you've followed the advice and none of your neighbors know you're a prepper. Well, if everybody else is losing 10 pounds a week and you're not, the neighbors are going to start figuring something out. And people it's that grasshopper ant mentality. People aren't going to say, well, good for Smith down the street. I wish I'd been a prepper like him. They're going to say, Smith down the street is starving my children because he has so much and he won't share it. So it's example after example.
Yeah.
People who might have gone into the Donner Party, friends, we're going to cross the mountain pass as friends. By the time the thing's over, they're in factions and they're fighting each other and it's down to cannibalism. So starvation will make you hate your neighbor who is not starving. And people have to mentally prepare for this.
Yeah, and hunger, it's crazy because your brain changes. This is something that a lot of people have never experienced. They can't relate to it, but hunger changes your thought process. It's just like extreme thirst. Once you start to experience extreme thirst, your channel capacity for doing any other task has shut down, and all of a sudden now your primary focus is on getting water. So if that's the case when it comes to extreme hunger, you're starting to think like on a more primitive, a very devious level, for lack of a better term, of, all right, I need food. I need food. This is my primary goal, and this is how I'm going to attain it. And I'm going to say that when we have the spoiled masses like we have in the United States, I mean, if they shut down the EBT card system for an hour, you've got chaos. I mean, it happened in Louisiana probably a couple years ago or a couple years back, where the EBT cards malfunctioned in just one town in Louisiana. And there was a Walmart that was literally broke out into chaos, and there was videos of it. So when you apply that on a larger scale coming out of this, and let's say just for objectivity's sake, that this virus is just a flu and it isn't that big of a deal, but the second and third order effects of people panicking from it ends up causing shortages and rationing and economic problems, which we're already experiencing.
And looting.
We're in the early stages of that.
But looting happens, the security environment will not permit the normal routine resupply. You know, once looting happens, right. Looting is like I forget the physics term, when the water turns to ice, when things change from like vapor to water or water to ice. It can be, it's like a tipping point in a sense. When the looting occurs, in present standard operating procedure status quo today, a McDonald's truck loaded with food can just drive down the boulevard and park, get gas, stay overnight at a truck rest stop, and then drop off all the food at McDonald's. No problem. Once the supermarkets and the restaurants are looted, that is gone. You can't just send tomorrow's McDonald's truck out, because it will be hijacked like Mad Max, you know, by starving people. So I compare this to people that have ever worked on a diesel engine know that it's very different from a gasoline car. It's just an analogy. If you take the high pressure fuel line apart, okay, and then you put it back to fix something, change an injector, you put it back together, you can't just turn the key and stomp on the gas pedal. I don't care if there's zombies outside the garage. You have got to do a long system of getting the fuel back all the way through the high pressure system, and it takes time. You don't just turn the key and go. When the food supply chain is broken, you don't just send out the same food trucks to the Winn-Dixie and the Publix and the Giant tomorrow, because the security and then you add to it, and that's without a pandemic, because in that security environment you'd need like a National Guard squad in a Humvee to protect every single food truck initially, and we don't have it. Then you add in a pandemic, those National Guard troops may be quarantined and sick. So we could have a tipping point moment where the markets get looted, the pharmacies, gun stores, liquor stores, they're looted. And then everybody, it's like Cambodia, Phnom Penh, 1975, year zero. Start your calendar from there. That's when somebody on your street has 2 days of food and somebody has 2 months of food, and in between is everybody else. And you start starving from there. And and then you add in that you can't allow people into your neighborhood. You're afraid of getting infected. And even like your relatives coming from a more dangerous city to your rural retreat, you're afraid they're bringing the COVID-19 because they could be an asymptomatic carrier. So even like your beloved children that have come back from school or come back from abroad, you can't just let them into your house. So socially, this is going to do a lot of really elemental restructuring that we're in no way thinking about. We're just in no way planning for the social and psychological spillovers of this.
Well, I mean, you mentioned that you've got a Welshman as a relative. And so one thing about being around the British that's very interesting, and I worked with them in Afghanistan, is that the Britons versus the Welshmen versus the Scots versus even down to culturally, they know based on facial structure what socioeconomic class you're from, which is very interesting. And that's they have different slang terms for all that, but you know, we don't really do that in the United States. We don't have much of a culturally, we don't really have a way to to entirely relate to that, to that, that mentality. But I see that coming back too, because when you start to see that, you know, this person is not from my town, or this person's not from, you know, my little area that, that I know everybody in my community, and suburbia, and the rise of suburbia, you know, the Levitt towns, the post-war period, and this efficiency of housing and whatnot has really destroyed a lot of small communities, because we no longer have that connectivity with
a heightened degree of tribalism is bound to sneak back in, because people are going to be scared, paranoid, freaked out in all directions. And something that has really changed in the, since I've been a shooter, since like say the 70s, I've been a shooter, is, you know, the prevalence of optics. And when you have a magnified optic, it's very basic to think, why do I want to get in a gunfight at 50 feet with a guy with an AK-47 when I can see him 300 yards away and I'll never need to see him again?
Exactly.
Then it starts to be, well, he's definitely not from my neighborhood, because there's no people of that ethnic persuasion in my neighborhood, so why should I even let him in? And then there's just a lot of, and I'm not just saying, you know, which ethnic group, there are a lot of animosities. You know, if you go to Los Angeles, it's like worse than Yugoslavia in terms of Asians, even split the Asians between Chinese, Vietnamese, Koreans. And then you've and then you've got, you know, the Norenos and Sureños among the Mexicans, and you've got the, you know, the Central Americans. They all hate each other, and they all hate the white guys, and they all hate the black guys. And this kind of a feeding frenzy of paranoia and fear over getting food is going to cause people to engage at distance. And the person coming might have a disease. You don't want them getting within disease range. Yep. So our country could be setting up for a catastrophe on, you know, I would say a biblical level. And it's sort of like a social pendulum. When you have children being given hormone blockers to prevent puberty, because at age like 9, they're saying, I don't want to be a girl, so I'm going to. There are adults, just like there were doctors who performed lobotomies, there are adult trans activists brainwashing children and then giving them hormone blockers. And this is just one example of many. I mean, you could go to the, you know, last day abortion, quote unquote. This is like a society that gets so out of whack. And even if you're not religious, even if you're not a believer, you can look at the Bible as a code for how to maintain a civilization without it going off the rails like a Sodom or a Gomorrah. And what is it? Basic. Yeah, somebody said the Bible stands for basic instruction before leaving Earth. Anyway, it's an instruction manual on how to create a society that can sustain itself. Monogamy is in there, things like that. Because you look at any of the Islamic countries that have multiple wives. Well, the rich guy gets all the hot girls, and then all the poor guys have no chance, and they're just pissed off, and you divert that anger into jihad. It's a society that's like a festering wound. Successful, happy societies that look like the Waltons. Well, and I'm not just saying the Bible. Maybe in Southeast Asia, Buddhism might work that way, even though you could say the priest class takes advantage or this or that. But you have to look at a society and say, has it been able to maintain for centuries and centuries without going off the rails, having a social explosion and consuming itself? And where we're going right now is way off the rails. You know, the just-in-time, mentioned, just-in-time. Okay, so some globalist billionaire class thinks that they can tweak their income, make more billions by having a just-in-time supply train for penicillin going back to China. You know, this is insanity. This is where Nassim Nicholas Taleb, He's one of the smartest guys on the planet, who wrote The Black Swan. He also wrote books like Anti-Fragile. We've created a very fragile system because it fed more money to a few people and it benefited them. They can buy the media to propagandize for globalism. You know, they can buy academia so that children will be brainwashed for globalism. But look where globalism has got us in 2020, COVID-19.
Yeah.
That's where it's got us.
Yeah. It has. And, you know, up on AP, Jesse James wrote a piece asking, will capitalism as a thing survive the 21st century? And that was the premise of it, that we've globalized ourselves and we have extended ourselves and through coercive, exploitative means as well, because that's what globalism is at the end of the day. And you know, there's not a lot of fair trade that's went on there. And now we've placed ourselves at the mercy of someone who errantly ate an infected bat. And now all of a sudden, you know, the whole house of cards is at risk of coming down.
We're at a couple of tipping points right here. And one is this whole nationalism versus globalism debate. The European Union would not even consider closing borders between Italy and Switzerland, Austria, Germany. Off the table. Yet because of the coincidence of the timing, you have millions of Syrian refugees that are in Turkey that are being foisted into Europe by the Turks. How many of them, if it's in Iran, how many of these people have this virus or carriers of this virus? So to the Greeks, this is now very real. You know, on the one hand, you have a bogus political arrangement like the European Union saying we won't even consider border controls. Then you've got NATO, where Greece and Turkey are allegedly NATO allies. And the Turks should, if it was a real alliance, the Turks would be saying, we're fighting the Russians. Come on, America, help us fight the Russians. We're saying, no way.
Yeah.
So the Turks are saying, well, we're going to send you a few million refugees we don't need in Turkey. All that want to come are going to Greece. Well, the Greeks are saying, we're not listening to the EU. The Schengen Agreement, out the window. We're sending troops to the border. We are issuing live ammunition. You know, I've seen them tipping over the rubber rafts with the patrol boats, you know, just zooming past them. Like, this is over. You know, Tell your people you're not getting in. They've cut through the fences. They've used live ammo. So the Greeks are reinforcing the border with troops, you know, not border guards, with regular army.
Yeah.
So this is at a point where national survival becomes at stake, like in Greece. So they're not only saying we'll be overrun with more refugees we can't feed, our economy's already busted, but they might be carrying this disease. So they're just saying no. So real world survival attitudes have to reemerge from this, you know, bogus globalist, you know, this silliness foisted on us that could never sustain itself. You know, it's a facade.
It's the idea of a global economy, at least in how, or in so much as the way it's been structured, and a lot of it borrows from Adam Smith, the Wealth of Nations, and then moving forward through that. But it can't work, because there is never the idea of free trade. There's never an equality in trade. There never is. There's always someone that's going to have the upper hand. And guess what? If I don't have the upper hand, then I'm just going to flood your nation full of people who are not like you, and they're going to decrease your value so that I'll end up having the upper hand. Go ahead.
Well, we could wind up with a very major demographic reset after this, either through floods of refugees or the other way, nationalists saying, we're going to be back to America when this thing's all over. We're going to be back to just Americans. So it could get very ugly, like civil wars do. But the idea of the globalist supply chain, I think Trump was on the right track, even though he was only putting it in economic terms, in terms of balance of trade. He's on the right track. when you go to Home Depot and all of the personal protective equipment is made in China, people have to be able to understand that's like relying on China to produce our ammunition or our military boots. You know, I look at the Korean War, going to the Korean War again, using just mass wave attacks. The Chinese communicated with bugles, whistles, and flares. Only at maybe like the battalion level was there some kind of a radio. But these attacks were done with like World War I technology. Now, if you want to buy state-of-the-art handheld radios capable of communicating several miles or HF sets, guess where they're all made? China. Yep. If we have to fight a war against what we think is a near peer, it might turn out that they have some surprises. It might turn out they have a battlefield EMP weapon that shuts down all of our gadgets, and it's back to AKs.
And we have evidence that they do. Yeah, you know, and all of a sudden that intermediate carbine. But you know, on that point, not to jump off on a small tangent.
And everybody has night vision. Not to mention, everybody has night vision. We're used to it being like, the British versus the natives, with the British with a Maxim gun and the natives, with a spear.
Yeah.
That's what our view of war has been. We own the sky. We own the night. The next time, it might not be like that.
That's right. And how many times have we heard from anti-gunners, folks on the left, I call them the leftist troll class, that the internet keyboard warriors, saying, the Second Amendment's outdated, you don't need to be armed because the government's got all this stuff, government's got tanks and aircraft and all this. Well, I would like to point out that we're in the process of signing a peace deal with the Taliban to get us out of Afghanistan, right? And I've got some mixed feelings on that and whatnot, but whatever. That part's irrelevant. The fact is that the Taliban is not even a third world entity. I would say that they're a fourth world or fifth world at best entity that only understands rudimentary concepts of fire and maneuver. Like, and I'm talking about rudimentary, like they might understand how to get online and basic flanking maneuvers. And that's it at the small unit level. But they were able to use their terrain. And what it all boiled down to was OCOCA, observation, fields of fire, cover and concealment, obstacles affecting movement, key terrain features and avenues of approach. They understand all of that. MET-TC, mission, enemy, time, terrain, troops, civilians on the battlefield. They understand those concepts. And they were very adept at using that and still are. And that's what made them very effective. So you could have a guy with a 50-year-old rusted-out AK with a shot-out barrel, and he can still be effective. I mean, and I hunted these guys. And I'm telling you, so for the anti-gunners out there that say, blah, 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 you don't need a firearm and whatever, you think you're going to take on whatever, that point is irrelevant. I don't sit there and teach people to take on anything. I teach them to defend themselves, number one. But that argument is null and void because look at where we are today, applying that to the larger conversation, or go ahead.
Well, in our context, facing a rising pandemic, I mean, it's ridiculous. They're not even calling it a pandemic. It was a pandemic a week ago by every definition. So they're purely playing semantics to avoid blame for being unprepared. But in our country, the ammunition has at least a 50-year shelf life minimum. And there are, more than one gun per American. But the food going to be gone way before the ammunition. And that's my fear, that this could devolve into just the excellent book A Failure of Civility posits the subdivision becoming a walled village and having a guard force at the one entrance to your subdivision because you can't guard 100 houses in a subdivision house by house. You have to stand up a guard force, put them at the perimeter so that you can live a normal life and just pull guard duty. Well, that's assuming that you're going out and getting food and that there's not a pandemic.
Yeah.
If people are afraid to visit their neighbor because they're seeing bodies in the backyard or in the front yard, then it even breaks down at the neighborhood level. And people who have a gun and ammunition but no food and hungry children are going to think about their neighbors that are not losing weight.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and on that note, you know, when you ask yourself who's in charge, why are they in charge? They're in charge because they're the ones providing the food. But as soon as that stops, and as soon as your ability to provide and give adequate task and purpose, those other people with the firearms, it's the same mentality when I was coming up in the Army as a young soldier and then as an NCO. One of the things I had my very first sergeant that I had who was very instrumental in how I developed over time as a leader. He had a huge impact on me, but he used to pull all of us guys aside. When I was a young team leader, he would pull us aside every Friday morning. And he would say on the days we weren't doing a company run or a battalion run or whatever, and he would say, "What are you doing for PT today?" And he would go and point at us individually, you know, and you tell him, he'd go, "You're going to run 5 miles. You're going to run 5 miles. You're going to run 5 miles." And he so on and so forth, pointing it out and saying, "And you're going to do it, not just, you know, not just an easy run on a Friday. I want you to pick the hardest, nastiest route you can and run it as fast as you can with your guys, because every day you should be proving to them why you should be in charge, right? You have to establish dominance over your younger guys. You have to prove to them. And if they can outdo you, they're going to look at you like, why are you in charge? I should be in charge."
Yeah.
You know, and so when we apply that mentality to prepping and a situation where, you know, people are banding together, kind of the tribal aspect of that, if all of a sudden I'm not providing for my people, I've got a young guy that I put a rifle in his hands over here, who's going to look at me and say, "Screw you, I'm in charge now. And what are you going to do about it?" And that's at best, he's going to challenge me in the open. At worst, he's going to kill me in my sleep.
I remember when I was a midshipman, we spent between sophomore and junior year, we spent a week at Camp Pendleton playing junior Marines. And we did these like forced ruck marches up and down these big sand mountains, you know, hundreds of feet elevation up and down. And you have like a caterpillar effect, stretching out and bunching up, going up and down the hills when you've got, you know, a couple hundred guys in a column. But I remember the major and the gunny sergeants, they were not only keeping up with us, they were letting everybody pass, seeing what's at the back of the file and then jogging ahead to the front. They were showing that they were out. They were older than us, and they were showing us by example. They had the whole column under their view, under their example. And then this is like 5 or 10 years ago. I just read about this, but it was a Marine Reserve unit. And I think like two guys died of dehydration. Well, in the same type of ruck marches that I did, because the leaders stayed up at the front where it's easy. At the front, you're going up the hill at your uphill speed and down the hill at your downhill speed at the front. The back is doing this caterpillar thing. So some people, when it stretched out, some people fell out and weren't even noticed. And they didn't even realize these guys were missing until they got home or got to base and finally did a head count, and they were missing troops. This is a complete breakdown in leadership. And I remember the example of these older, you know, the veterans that were not just staying up at the front where everything's rosy. They were covering the entire column. And if leaders aren't willing to do that, then it is going to break down. And those guys at the back that realize they're being abandoned, How's their morale and how's their discipline and how likely are they to follow orders when they finally catch up to the main herd and they realize nobody even knew they were gone? I mean, and at a social level, to be the leader of your family or of your neighborhood, I get out in the neighborhood and I ran until I was 60. My knees just finally quit, but I bike a lot and I still get out on walks around the neighborhood. And part of that is I want to be seen, because when the shit hits the fan and there's just a gaggle, I want to be able to identify the other leaders at our first community meetings and have a sense of who can be the other, you know, NCOs of this, because if it's just a shouting match at these meetings, we're all going down. So, you know, at every level, leadership, whether it's just your own family, you know, you have to overcome resistance to buy a lot of survival food, because the non-prepper mentality considers that silly, because everybody's life, a supermarket has been 5 minutes away or a half hour away with all the food you can load into a truck all the time. So you have to overcome a lot of this in advance. That's also leadership.
Yeah. Yeah. And recognizing that there's a common larger goal that everybody has to work towards in order to accomplish something. And that's a tough thing to do. It's in being a tactical trainer and an advisor for a few years now, doing stuff on the civvy side. One of the things that I've noticed about the difference between successful prepper groups over time and unsuccessful prepper groups is the leadership and the leader of that group. The ones that have not been very successful have all had one thing in common. The leader has been very overbearing and demanding of the people that have been involved in it, saying you have to do this and you have to do that. And it becomes too much like work. And so the other guys, the other families that are part of that group, they say, nah, you know, they might be interested in it for a little while, and then eventually they'll find excuses not to be part of it and it'll fade off. But the ones that have been very successful over time have been a much more laid back. They've had a much more laid back approach to it. And they've been real calm, easygoing, and approached it more like a hobby and a club. And the difference has been night and day, because it's a better way of looking at things. So, you know, and when we extend that to a grid down thing, you know, when we're talking about, like, you know, you've been through BUDS and several schools and you know, in the Army, it's similar with different schools that introduce stressors. And the guys that are going to succeed, whether it's Ranger school or sniper school or SFAS or, you know, whatever school that you're going to, elite school, ARSLIC, whatever, it's the guys that have the laid back attitude that don't get super stressed out over everything, even when it's the stressors are put on them. They're typically the ones that are going to be more successful. The guys that freak out over the small stuff and get nitpicky down in the details, they're normally not going to cut it. And I know that that's a broad, I'm painting with a very broad brush there. Yep. But generally, it's true. The more laid back guys are better off.
I think that, you know, the reason that this discussion has veered into like a leadership avenue, talking about prepper groups, in a pandemic, it's not likely we're going to be able to have people from, you know, distant regions assemble for, you know, the as planned prepper, jamboree. It's more likely that you're going to be forced to quarantine in place. It could be your apartment building, could be your subdivision, could be, you know, your rural road with five farms on it. But the leadership that we're talking about is going to be key, because if you just leave it up to whatever the average person thinks that day, and these are people under stress that haven't put a lot of thought into this, you know, they're going to need guidance. If we're going to get through this as successfully as possible, the group around you is the group you're going to have. It's not going to be probably you know, your tactically trained prepper buddies. Each one of these preppers, in a sense, is going to have to be the nucleus around which forms your little island of civility in an overall sea of a failure of civility, to reference that book. But you can't wait for John Wayne. Number one, John Wayne is not coming, okay, in the form of a National Guard colonel with a truck full of MREs. You can't expect John Wayne to come. You have to be John Wayne.
Right.
You know, you have to look in the mirror and say, if it's not going to be me, who is it going to be? My neighbors that don't even own guns or, you know, never considered the chance that a supermarket would be looted. You know, the leader has to be the prepper, and you can't do it on your own. That going back to a failure of civility, unless you are like James Wesley Rawls and you live on a mountain by yourself with, you know, 10 years worth of diesel for your generators, everybody else is going to have to form a little island of civility, where whether it's your building, your subdivision, your apartment, you're going to have to form that island of civility. And that's going to require leadership and wisdom. And, you know, that's why we're doing podcasts like these. It's not, you know, I'm not seeking recognition. You're not seeking recognition. We're trying in our own ways to raise the discourse so that more people are more prepared. And I think that it's the wrong approach to just think I'm bunkering out in my house and the hell with my neighbors.
Yeah.
Because when they see you're not starving, they are going to be.
You can't.
You can't. You can't bunker out. You're going to have to deal with your neighbors. You're going to have to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's something that I've found kind of lacking in the prepper movement, so to speak, because we all get very dialed in on politics and you and I are very politically conservative, but you know, like for my example, I live close to a large organic farm. The owner of that farm, I mean, I wouldn't call them necessarily like far left. They're definitely left of center people. You know, I don't have to discuss national politics with them. We find common ground on a lot of other stuff. And at the end of the day, when national politics have rendered themselves irrelevant, they're still my neighbors. I still know them. I still deal with them on a daily basis. They still deal with me. And what's more important, the fact that they have a decade of knowledge of growing things from the ground, off the grid, or organically, doing everything very naturally, and they're successful at it. Their livelihood is staked upon their ability to grow food out of the ground. That's what they do.
Yeah, they're valuable. So that's a valuable resource.
They're valuable. And so would it be right for me to sit here and alienate them and say, oh, you know, you don't think exactly the same way I do, so the hell with you? Or say, you know, hey, look, we disagree on some stuff, that's fine. But, you know, we might not disagree on things on a lot of stuff now, but we may find ourselves agreeing on a lot more stuff later on down the road.
Yeah. Investing all of our psychological energy in national political fighting, it has left us at this point. You know, the big R or the big D, they were both on the globalism track, just slightly different flavors in time economy and source to China. So, you know, there's no point in continuing that debate when our leaders have proven themselves to be naked emperors, period. We are in this place because of our leadership.
Yeah. So, not to shift gears, but kind of to shift gears, I have a couple other questions for you that totally not coronavirus or any of that related, but I think that you're going to like it. And it's questions that I haven't heard anybody ever ask you. and it's about your novels. So there's one thing that's always stood out about your work and your writing that's been very appreciated, both by myself, but was noted by other guys. You were very popular in our detachment in Afghanistan, all three of your books at that time, the Enemies Foreign and Domestic trilogy. But there's always one thing that has made your novel stand out from the rest of what I call genre fiction of prepping and survival and whatnot. And it's that, number one, they're well written, but you don't have any so-called Mary Sue characters. You don't have the one, the guy with, all the guns and he's, the characters that instantly just figure everything out and they're going at the end of the day, the basic fiction storytelling A plus B equals C kind of deal. You don't have any of that in your books. You have deeply flawed, relatable people, whether it's the protagonist or the antagonist. And so on that note, what's your muse behind that? And are your characters generally framed around real people?
Well, thanks. That's an awesome question. You know, the Mary Sue novels where you have, I would put in this category and look, if you're asking my wife, would she wish that I'd written crap novels that were million sellers? Yes. Do I wish that I could just write crap novels that were million sellers? I'd be off on a, 80-foot catamaran somewhere, like Clive Cussler or something, who just passed away, by the way, not knocking Clive Cussler, Brad Thor type of novelist, the Lee Child, you've got guys that are all pure Mary Sue. They speak three languages, and it's always that whatever country they're in, they speak Farsi or Russian, they're always a Tom Cruise who can like impersonate a Russian general in the Kremlin. To the point of bracing up Russian privates about their uniform. I mean, this is, to me, it makes me puke because it's, now if it's just like a Jason Statham transporter kind of film, I take it for what it is. it's just an action. Right. He's going to be able to drive his Audi on two wheels across a footbridge. I get it. But if it's supposed to be a novel where you're going to learn some things, then, I'm not knocking as people, guys like Clive Cussler, Vince Flynn, Brad Thor. I'm not knocking them. They outsell me 100-1, I'm sure. But I was never interested in doing that because in my writing, I want my novels to endure. And I've always hearkened back to, as an example, Herman Melville, who in his own life was briefly moderately successful. But then he was so broke that he quit and he went to work at the post office, because he didn't make it as a writer after a while. It wasn't until after his death that his works were reexamined, Moby Dick and others. And he was legit. He wrote one of his short novellas is called Typee, T-Y-P-E-E. And he had actually been on a whaling ship and lived in the Marquesa Islands, which were cannibal islands. And when he wrote Typee, the critics said he had made it up. It was BS. It was completely, it was a complete fiction. And it wasn't until long after his death that anthropologists went to the places he described. And the local, like every valley had a different dialect. The local valleys that he described, living among the cannibal tribes, they used those exact words he had used a century earlier. So he wasn't BSing. It was legit. But while he was alive, he did not become a bestseller. He did not, become world famous. He eventually quit and went to work for the post office. But would I rather be Brad Thor in my lifetime and rich on the 80-foot catamaran in the Caribbean, or would I rather write the best novels that I could for posterity and for the long run, regardless of the commercial appeal? And I've decided to go that way. So all of my characters are flawed individuals. They're not supermen. They don't, like, you know, they don't square canopy parachute into the Kremlin, you know, and then, you know what I mean, pull off their Zoom suit, and they got a Russian general uniform on, and they happen to just speak and they're, oh, by the way, their girlfriend is a Mossad agent who runs a fashion model business on the side. So you've always got a, you know, hot chicks around. You know what I mean? That's literally what best-selling thrillers are.
We all love that, though.
I don't get anything from that. But I also like, because I am a prepper at heart and a teacher at heart, I wanted to reach people with lessons about what you can do. In my novels, not everybody is a sniper. You know, in Domestic Enemies, there's a guy running a RV park in the panhandle of Texas who's a cripple in a wheelchair. But the RV park is very important, like a meeting and resupply point for survivors of what's going on in that novel. And at the same time, so he's got a source of income because you have to pay to keep your RV there temporarily. You can't stay long. So that's a supply. He's got a source of income that's practical. And he's financing small plane flights into New Mexico, which is under the control of foreign enemies. So everybody, even a cripple in a wheelchair that can figure out a gig that has a cash flow, can do something to benefit. And all of my characters, I try to make like that. They have something unique that they can offer, that they bring to the table, and not just that, you know, they've always got it some a rifle that can, you know, but as far as guns, I try to achieve a balance. Like, it's just easier to say a Glock 19 than to say he has a Sig Sauer X model and then describe the sights and describe the difference in the trigger assembly. So a lot of gun writers in the prepper community, they get sidetracked into, you know, describing like how the night vision scope works, and there's like three pages on the night vision scope. So you got to, but on the other hand, and that'll lose all the non-tactical people. But if you if you make any mistakes, you lose the tactical people. There was a famous novel called, I think it's called Hostage by, it was actually made into a movie. But the book starts, it's a couple of gangbangers end up taking over like a rich guy's house and turning it into a hostage scenario. It was actually made into a movie with Bruce Willis. But where this crime initiates is at a convenience store holdup. And the Korean grocer, because there's a shootout, and when they get away, they can only get away to like the nearest millionaire mansion. You know, they hole up and become a hostage situation. Turns out that the millionaire mansion is like a mafia place with millions of dollars in it. But anyway, going back to the very beginning, like first five pages, convenience store robbery, the Korean grocer draws his Glock and under stress failed and forgot to put off the thumb safety of his Glock. Okay? And therefore, he gets shot. So the writer of a best-selling novel, sold millions of copies, made into a movie, didn't know that a Glock doesn't have a thumb safety. His editor didn't know. Nobody all the way up to the publishing house knew. Nobody that proofread it knew. So when I see that, you know, silly stuff like that, I know that he's also making it up about banking. He's making it up about currency. He's making it up about the mafia. I lose all credibility if they can't do the basics like that. So I try in all my novels to only write about what I know, you know, and as a result, I keep them more down to earth. I don't have like, you know, C-130s and guys, you know, doing halo jumps, because you know, I keep it to what preppers thrown into an emergency could accomplish. Maybe somebody has a PVS-14, maybe, but probably not, you know, not these preppers that are all kitted out with everything, the latest and greatest, you know, anyway.
Yeah. And you know, nobody's going to be on jump status, you know, when things are falling apart. I mean, it, for anybody that doesn't know about that, I mean, you and I know, but the logistics required just for that, as well as the technical know-how, it's just, yeah, almost inconceivable.
I think that if anybody read one of my novels, I would probably suggest, well, I'd like you to read the whole trilogy, but in Foreign Enemies and Traitors, they wind up hiding in a cave in Tennessee. You've got an old Vietnam veteran. You've got a current Special Forces sniper who's a deserter because the Army's been basically, the Army's gone international. And, you know, the Army has been subverted. You've got a conscript soldier who was just in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, when the earthquake hits. And he's not really a soldier. He's just a soldier in name only. He ends up making a phone call to his mother and compromising the whole mission. You know, that. So I have people come together from different walks of life, different individual survival stories, not just a prepper group. Or the worst cliche is, you know, all these like, you know, when the power went out, I was 800 miles away and I've got to shoot my way, you know, I've got to shoot my way home 800 miles, you know, that's been just written to death. I'm really sick of it. I like the two novels that I've written more lately because they're a little bit like post dystopia where I can explore like, okay, there's no more GPS. There's no more, you know, nations are really dwindling in power. The Europeans aren't standing up any more navies. So piracy is back. You know, how do you navigate in a world where you've got to go back to learning the sextant, where just finding a time tick, meaning a reliable time check so that you can do celestial navigation, that's your high tech challenge, is keep maintaining a radio and finding a reliable time tick. You know, GPS is gone. Yeah. International banking is gone. That's what I like writing about
now. That's something. When I do the HF portion in the late afternoon, you know, day one of the RTO course, I do that. I show people how to, if they're using HF, to tune it into 10 megahertz and get the time. Because back when I was a kid, there was a phone number that you could call. And it was giving you the same thing. But the U.S. atomic clock on 10 megahertz puts out to the second a time every day, you know. And so 24/7, you can pick the signal up if you have the proper.
When that goes down,
Oh, yeah.
When there's no more time tick.
But I'll say that that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about the Red Cliffs of Zerhun was that aspect, but the fact that even in that novel you had, you know, this team of SAS guys, incredibly well trained. You know, the SAS is world renowned, you know, the kind of the progenitor of special operations as we know it.
David Sterling.
And and even the best, the literal, the best of the best, these guys are out there to rescue those girls that were being held hostage, and the plan completely falls apart at sea, literally. And you know, man, I love that. I love that swerve and that element in there, because now, not to spoil it for anybody that might listen that hasn't read. But now they went from best case scenario instantly to worst case scenario, and with only a couple of the guys from the team that are. And what do you do now? You still have to continue mission. You still have to Charlie Mike.
That's right.
You know, it's not an option to just sit there and roll over like a dying cockroach or your back and say, well, shit, you know, what are we going to do now? I guess we're going to die. Yeah,
there's no
extraction.
There's no Navy or amphibious ready group over the horizon coming with Ospreys and a Marine at QRF. Doesn't exist. You know, you're just a half dozen guys stranded in Morocco that don't look anything like locals and don't speak Arabic. So you're basically screwed. Yeah. You've got your basic load. You've got your M16A1. And I love the plot because those great SAS guys, They've got the training, but they have no guns. They can't in Britain find guns. So they have to cooperate with the old IRA guys who have weapons caches that they never turned in.
Yep.
So to get the weapons, they have to actually cooperate. And part of that is get over your small squabbles. And I'm not saying the SAS versus the IRA was a small squabble, but they are united by a common mission of rescuing nearly 100, you know, English and Irish schoolgirls who are kidnapped by pirates from Ireland. They thought they were safe there. But just like in the old days, the Corsairs roll up with a long-range converted fishing boat, AK-47s and Zodiacs, kidnap the girls, take them back to Morocco for, you know, for ransom. Well, the IRA and the SAS have to cooperate. And that's part of the book that, you know, we can't bog down in my neighborhood versus your neighborhood, my football team versus you. You've got to get to a, like you and the organic farm guy, your organic farm neighbor. You got to get to a higher level of cooperation. But then when the whole plan goes sideways, you have to, on the fly, figure out a whole new plan. Your leaders are gone. 90% of your equipment is gone. And you're stranded in a foreign land where you don't speak the language and don't look local. And you've still got to come up with a plan. You know, and that's what I like, is I like challenging people to think that way. And keep the reader surprised. I like to keep the reader surprised. That's why in the first book, you know, characters that you assume are going to be like long-term characters through all my novels. In the first one, I kill one off so that readers will never assume that there's like a Brad Thor, Dirk Pitt kind of a super guy, like the Lee Child, you know, Jack Reacher kind of character. You know, Jack Reacher in my first book, he's killed right off. So you never know who's going to be the one that lasts. But that's what I was trying to do, keep readers interested.
It's why I asked the question, because that's so radically different. It's an element of realism that's introduced into the writing that you don't get from a novel that's there to entertain you. With your writing, entertainment is secondary, I think, or at least that's what I've got out of it. The entertainment value is secondary. The imparted lessons and just the story, when you're done with it, it sticks with you more because you develop an emotional attachment. For me, especially with the Blue Book, with Foreign Enemies and Traitors, in that book, you know, they have Boone Vikerson has the meeting with the other Green Berets and you know his detachment is there, and the old team daddy comes out and they're, you know, they're having their forbidden meeting, and the guys, I think his wife was Vietnamese or maybe it was Thai, and she goes into the other room, you know, and he says, you know, hey, this is what we have here is sacred, you know, and they're having their meeting.
Yeah, a Green Beret on a Bible. A Green Beret on a Bible with all their hands on it.
Yeah.
We're taking this all the way.
I've had those conversations with people, you know, and I've had that level of conversation with guys when I was in the army, when there was very uncertain times, you know, we had those conversations like what if things start to fall apart? I mean, after the 2012 election, there was a lot of uncertainty. There was a whole lot of uncertainty and a lot of anger I'd like to say that it's got better. You know, obviously I'm not a part of that. I'm outside of that world now, but people were having those conversations.
A large part of that real world camaraderie, like do or die in it to the bitter end camaraderie, comes from the knowledge that, unlike say Iwo Jima, if somebody took a wrong picture and it's next thing you know, you got a JAG investigation, you could be going to jail. If they had cameras on Iwo Jima, you know, we look at World War II and we go, wow, those Japanese are fanatics. Only 500 surrendered. Let me tell you, the 500 that were alive at the end of Iwo Jima weren't the only ones that were trying to surrender. The Marines were not in a capturing prisoner mode on Iwo Jima. And it was a fight to the, you know, I have a, my father-in-law, deceased father-in-law was a radio man on Iwo Jima from day one, 5th Marine Division, saw the flag go up on Mount Suribachi with his own eyes. Mm-hmm. We saw a documentary and it showed a fire team with flamethrowers and Japanese running out of a bunker on fire. And I asked him if they would shoot them to put them out of their misery. You know, they're running out on fire. He said, hell no. We weren't there to make their lives easy. You know, they were there to make make the Japanese suffer and pay. And they were in a bitter, angry mode. And, you know, that the myth that only a few Japanese surrendered. Yeah, it was hard to surrender. It was hard to accomplish a surrender with those Marines. But post 9/11, you do something that would have been routine on Iwo Jima, you could wind up for life in Leavenworth. And you know, you're doing stuff that militarily is required, it's demanded, but there's going to be a JAG manual JAG investigation out of it that could put you in prison for life. So it changes the trust up the chain of command.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. It absolutely does. And I think that's why with us, that was why your books resonated. I mean, we had a few others that we were reading at the time and kind of passing around, you know, of similar genre. But that's why your novels stuck with the guys and got very popular, because these were characters, these were people that we knew, you know, the personalities and everything else, the very human aspect of it. We knew these people. These were guys in our detachment, you know, and it was really cool, even the linkage between
like, I was very key on the linkage between generations, the, you know, the old Vietnam era special forces guy with the new guy. They've never met, but it turns out that their fathers knew, you know, that they had people that so much in common that when the younger Green Beret meets the, you know, granddaddy Green Beret, there's a link immediately.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They fit like Legos off. And that trust, it's hard to explain that outside of the military community, how that works. And that's something I try to convey in my novels, you know, how that works for good and for bad, because, you know, there's people that are willing to sell them out, that are willing to, you know, get a high ranking job with the federal government to basically, you know, round up and ship these people out. You know, they'll do that too.
Yeah.
You know, but
you'll find that it's real.
I think that the greatest praise that I get for my books, and it's, you know, it's worth a lot to me, is people have told me they've like read the trilogy 3 times, and there's very few books in my life I've even read twice. But the other thing is, and I'm not comparing myself to Herman Melville by any means, I wish I could write better and more rapidly, had a quicker turnaround, more novels. But I tried to write the best that I could with my thought. If I had to choose between, you know, schlocky bestseller trash now, or something that will last and endure and explain what happened in this era, you know, nobody's going to go back and read a Brad Thor novel 50 years from now. It won't even be a thought.
People trying to
understand this era of, you know, the early 2000s, I hope that they do go back and read my novels, because I hope that it like resonates and explains this era.
I think that it will. I know, you know, I found you all way back when you first appeared in Soldier of Fortune, and I was in high school.
Robert K. Brown.
And growing up, it's growing up in the 90s and being aware of things and being a very avid reader of Soldier of Fortune, and then going on into the Army and doing the things that I did. I'll say that I think that your novels will have accomplished that goal, certainly explaining that the transition period between the political turmoil of the 90s into the 2000s, because I think contemporary history will want to whitewash a lot of things with, I mean, we've already seen that with how the left kind of romanticizes George W. Bush now in that era. But I remember being an undergrad and seeing, you know, like the left then, they said all the same things they're saying about Trump. They said about Bush then, you know, oh, he's a Nazi and, you know, no blood for all and all this stuff. He's Hitler and you know, all this stuff, literally all the same things and just as militant about it. And to see them romanticize him now, which they were doing, when H.W. Bush died, it's they've whitewashed that part of history. And I think that your novels, your work, as well as the work of others, John Ross with Unintended Consequences, is another really good one. But it's gonna highlight the you know, things were not okay during that period. Things were not okay. Things were not okay domestically, and as well as the relatability factor. Like, you know, these are novels that aren't written just for the sake of entertainment. There's a lot more on other levels that's being said here, and I think it's going to endure. I think that you've accomplished that goal.
I think that, well, it's said, you know, truthfully said that the victors get to write the history. And, you know, just that example of Iwo Jima, you know, only a few more Japanese surrendered. They were really tough. So, you know, that they didn't write the Japanese version of what happened because those guys were dead. But and that's just a microcosm example. But with what's coming, if this pandemic breaks loose and is like the comeuppance, the biblical proportion comeuppance of globalism and just in time and all of that, then all of the other previous histories are going to be discredited. It's going to be, how did you lead us into this trap? Why did you lead us for your own profit at the top? Why did you lead your entire country into a trap where not only did this virus come out of China, but the products we needed, like the penicillin for the pneumonia, and it all came from China. It all stopped at the same time. How did you do that? So writers like me, who are kind of contrarian to the general mainstream media conventional wisdom myth, then mm-hmm. contrarian novelists like me will get more credibility, because that was part of my goal all along. I even when I was writing Enemies Foreign and Domestic, I wanted to be paid attention to when the crisis happened. I wanted to be a voice that people would heed when the crisis happened. And to do that, I had to write some things that were ahead of the over the horizon, you know, ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
Seeming hyperbolic. Like in Foreign Enemies and Traitors, which is only 10 years old, I've got, you know, men dancing in the officers' club. I mean, male couples. And the old Blackhawk pilots are like, can't believe it. How did it come to this?
Yeah.
You know, when I wrote that, it's like, oh, come on, Matt. There'll never be gay couples in Fort Bragg. Really? It's happened. West Point weddings. Yeah. You know, Brad and Bruce under the swords at West Point. So I think we are going to have that.
We've got an open communist that's running for president. You know, as a serious candidate, he's not
That's
just
right.
a joke. It's real.
That's right.
We have a communist graduating from West Point. His combination cover saying, hey, communism will win.
Yeah, like, but Bernie Sanders, by what Bernie Sanders takes out of a century of communism is that they had a massive literacy program in Cuba and cheap subways in Moscow. So he's saying, I'm good with the 100 million murdered. Okay. This is the communist mentality. Ends justify the means. You got to break some eggs to make an omelet,
exactly.
You know, and he's willing to break a lot of eggs to make an omelet. And that's why the Second Amendment is so important, because in other countries, when you get a leader like that, you just have to go for the ride because you're disarmed. You know, the European Jews or the the Russian kulaks. But it will be a harder nut to accomplish because they will not be able to just have a revolution. The counter-revolution will be extremely well-armed. And in my novels, I show that where you have a traitor federal government working, you know, with the international forces, but there are people even still inside the FBI who are hearing things, and then their part of the whole program, their effort is to get word out for what's happening inside the FBI, showing that it won't even be a monolithic takeover of the federal government. There will be people, you know, leaking information to the patriots on the outside. And when I wrote these novels, it seems hyperbolic, but in the light of things like Fast and Furious, which was a murder program, you know, Fast and Furious was a government mass murder program. The intention was push guns into Mexico, have them found at murder scenes or trace the murder scenes, and then blame the Second Amendment. That was the essence of Fast That's and right. Furious. And that, to me, was no morally not any different than the beginning of Enemies Foreign and Domestic with a massacre at a stadium, you know, false flag massacre at a stadium. Except in the case of Fast and Furious, more people at a higher level knew about it. At least 300 Mexicans, and that's old information, were killed with those guns on purpose. That was murder for a political outcome. So I had already written the stadium massacre. That was just a couple ATF mid-level, you know, managers. That wasn't like ATF headquarters. So, you know, imagine Fast and Furious was a mass murder program carried out at the same time Hillary Clinton and the others were going on national television and repeating the trope that 90% of the guns found in Mexico at murder scenes came from America. That was the publicity end of the program. ATF was doing the gun pushing, you know, the gun walking part of the program. But they were actually working together to accomplish a political goal out of mass murder. So imagine a Bernie Sanders in control of the armed forces, the FBI, the NSA. You know, it will be very difficult because, as we saw after Richmond, they know all the people that will go to Richmond. Well, they've got those names and all their social network connections. You know, that's an easy roundup right there. Richmond? Come with us. And then you add in this COVID-19. There's a meme going around saying, you know, Thursday night, knock on the door. There's 10 people outside wearing hazmat suits and police uniforms saying, come with us. You've got to go into quarantine. So under the cover of a pandemic, a lot of things can be hidden. You know, a lot of things will never be explained.
They won't. They simply won't. And it's the Hong Kong protest is you know, at least on pause right now. I'm not seeing much coming out of Hong Kong anymore. And you know, we can directly point to this virus in China. That's China right. took great advantage of the opportunity afforded them.
They may inherit Africa, for example. They may just inherit Africa. Yeah. They've already put in the infrastructure, and the population's going to die.
That was going to be my next point. Was economically, it's neocolonialism, and it's something that I haven't seen discussed too much outside of academic circles. Is the Chinese neocolonialism and their programs of neocolonialism. When this got dropped in Lagos, Nigeria, this virus, it's gonna boom, and it's going to spread. We can assume that it has already spread throughout much of Africa already, and it's just flying under the radar, because like in the Congo, for example, medical care is rudimentary at best, if just a generous thought at worst. And you know, with that said, they're not they're gonna be people that are infected, and then we're talking about getting into the summer months. What if Ebola breaks back out again? Because Ebola has been a summer month illness. So if that spreads on top of COVID And you're talking about the medical system, Doctors Without Borders, so on and so forth in Africa, that is already strained to a limit.
When we come to
major political upheaval there.
I think we're going to see in the near future that modern jetliners are like a coronavirus mixing lab, and air travel is going to be extremely restricted. It's not just going to be daily flights from Lagos to New York. It's going to be extremely restricted.
Yep.
But I'd like to put in a plug, because there's so much to learn from it. Movie about the 30 Years' War in Europe called The Last Valley. It didn't have big distribution in the United States. It's Michael Caine is like a warlord mercenary captain. And Omar Sharif is like a refugee. Yeah, and you can watch it on YouTube. Just go to the first segment, and it'll be like 12 minutes. Watch the whole movie, because that's the type of war we're going to be in for, where it's not just, the Catholics versus the Protestants, and there's the line, like the American Civil War. It's bands of mercenaries that will fight for whoever can pay them. You know, this is a 30-year war. It goes through a lot of evolution. And people in a remote valley, like a prepper community, is just trying to survive when a detachment of mounted warlords show up. This could be, Idaho, and it will be ATVs and pickups instead of horses.
Yeah.
But the movie has lessons, very deep lessons. So I recommend everybody just go on YouTube and watch The Last Valley. Terrific movie. Very underrated.
Yeah.
I wish it would be like digitally remastered. And
Michael Caine and Omar Sharif together in a movie is worth watching enough.
I love that Michael he's got Caine the spiked helmet. He has the spiked helmet. And he's talking to Omar Sharif about, well, what would you do with people who don't go with the program? And I don't want to do a spoiler, but I never saw the spiked helmet used as a weapon. I didn't say to kill him. You philosophers are all hypocrites. He's wiping the blood off the.
Mr. Brown, I'm going to say it's been an absolute honor to have you on with us, and I hope to do it again. We're coming up on an hour and 45 minutes, able to talk to you. I've been a big fan of yours for a really, really long time, all the way going back to 2000, when you were appearing in Soldier of Fortune. And, it's an honor to have you on board with us at American Partisan. And it's just an honor to be able to speak to you and get an interview with you when asking some questions that I'm not sure if you're going to be asked in other venues.
Thank you.
I really, really appreciate it.
I hope to get FaceTime with you over the campfire at Camp Boogaloo again in the not too distant future.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, man. Well, hey, God bless you and yours. And I will see you very soon.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Yes, sir.